back, and is trampled. He rolls over on his stomach, laces his hands over his head, and waits for it to be over. Julia Shumway clicks and clicks and clicks. Perhaps the pictures will reveal the faces of people she knows, but she sees only strangers in the viewfinder. A mob. Rupe Libby draws his sidearm and fires four shots into the air. The gunfire rolls off into the warm morning, flat and declamatory, a line of auditory exclamation points. Toby Whalen dives back into the car, bumping his head and knocking off his cap. Chester's Mill deputy on the front in yellow. He snatches the bullhorn off the back seat, puts it to his lips, and shouts, "Stop what you're doing! Back off, police! Stop! That is an order!" Julia snaps him. The crowd pays no attention to the gunshots or the bullhorn. They pay no attention to Ernie Calvert when he comes around the side of the building with his green duster churning about his pumping knees. "Come in the back," he yells. "You don't need to do that. I've opened up the back." The crowd is intent upon breaking and entering. They smash against the doors with their stickers reading "In and Out" and "Everyday Low Prices." The doors hold at first, then the lock snaps under the crowd's combined weight. The first to arrive are crushed against the doors and suffer injuries. Two people with broken ribs, one sprained neck, two broken arms. Toby Whalen starts to raise the bullhorn again, then just sets it down, with exquisite care, on the hood of the car in which he and Rupe arrived. He picks up his deputy cap, brushes it off, puts it back on. He and Rupe walk toward the store, then stop, helpless. Linda and Marty Arsenault join them. Linda sees Marta and leads her back to the little cluster of cops. "What happened?" Marta asked, dazed. "Did someone hit me? The side of my face is all hot. Who's watching Judy and Janelle?" "Your sister took them this morning," Linda says and hugs her. "Don't worry."
"Cora?"
"Wendy." Cora, Marta's older sister, has been living in Seattle for years. Linda wonders if Marta has suffered a concussion. She thinks that Dr. Haskell should check her, and then remembers that Haskell is either in the hospital morgue or the Bowie funeral home. Rusty is on his own now, and today, he's going to be very busy. Carter is half-carrying Georgia toward Unit 2. She is still howling those eerie moose-blower cries. Amel Searles has regained some soupy semblance of consciousness. Frankie leads him toward Linda, Marta, Toby, and the other cops. Mel tries to raise his head, then drops it back into his chest. His split forehead is pouring blood. His shirt is soaked. People stream into the market. They race along the aisles, pushing shopping carts or grabbing baskets from a stack beside the charcoal briquettes display. "Have yourself a fall cookout," the sign reads. Manuel Ortega, Alden Dinsmore's hired man, and his good friend Dave Douglas go straight to the checkout cash registers and start punching no-sale buttons, grabbing money and stuffing it into their pockets, laughing like fools as they do so. The supermarket is full now. It is sale day. In frozen foods, two women are fighting over the last Pepperidge Farm lemon cake. In deli, one man baffs another man with a kielbasa, telling him to leave some of that goddamn lunch meat for other folks. The lunch meat shopper turns and biffs the kielbasa wielder in the nose. Soon they are rolling on the floor, fists flying. Other brawls are breaking out. Rance Conroy, proprietor and sole employee of Conroy's Western Maine Electrical Service and Supplies, smiles our specialty, punches Brendan Ellerby, a retired University of Maine science teacher, when Ellerby beats him to the last large sack of sugar. Ellerby goes down, but he holds on to the 10-pound bag of dominoes, and when Conroy bends to take it, Ellerby snarls, "Here, then," and smacks him in the face with it. The sugar sack bursts wide open, enveloping Rance Conroy in a white cloud. The electrician falls against one of the shelves, his face as white as a mime's, screaming that he can't see, he's blind. Carla Venziano, with her baby goggling over her shoulder from the carrier on her back, pushes Henrietta Clavard away from the display of Tex Mighty rice. Baby Stephen loves rice. He also loves to play with the empty plastic containers, and Carla means to make sure he has plenty. Henrietta, who was 84 in January, goes sprawling on the hard knot of scrawn that used to be her butt. Lissa Jameson shoves Will Freeman, who owns the local Toyota dealership, out of her way so she can get the last chicken in the cold case. Before she can grab it, a teenage girl wearing a Punk Rage t-shirt snatches it, sticks out her pierced tongue at Lissa, and hies gaily away. There's a sound of shattering glass followed by a hearty cheer, made up mostly, but not entirely, of men's voices. The beer cooler has been breached. Many shoppers, perhaps planning on having themselves a fall cookout, stream in that direction. Instead of open up, the chant is now beer, beer, beer. Other folks are streaming into the storerooms below and out back. Soon men and women are packing wine out by the jug and the case. Some carry cartons of vino on their heads like native bearers in an old jungle movie. Julia, her shoes crunching on crumbles of glass, shoots, shoots, shoots. Outside, the rest of the town cops are pulling up, including Jackie Weddington and Henry Morrison, who have abandoned their post at the gas and grocery by mutual consent. They join the other cops in a huddled worry cluster off to one side and simply watch. Jackie sees Linda Everett's stricken face and folds Linda into her arms. Ernie Calvert joins them, yelling, "So unnecessary! So completely unnecessary!" with tears streaming down his chubby cheeks. "What do we do now?" Linda asks, her cheek pressed against Jackie's shoulder. Marta stands close beside her, gaping at the market and pressing a palm against the discolored, rapidly swelling bruise on the side of her face. Beyond them, Food City surges with yells, laughter, the occasional cry of pain. Objects are thrown. Linda sees a roll of toilet tissue unspooling like a party streamer as it arcs over the housewares aisle. "Honey," Jackie says, "I just don't know." 11. Anson snatched Rose's shopping list and went running into the market with it before the lady herself could stop him. Rose hesitated beside the restaurant panel truck, clenching and unclenching her hands, wondering whether or not to go in after him. She had just decided to stay put when an arm slipped around her shoulders. She jumped, then turned her head and saw Barbie. The depth of her relief actually weakened her knees. She clutched his arm, partly for comfort, mostly so she wouldn't faint. Barbie was smiling, without much humor. "Some fun, huh, kid?"
"I don't know what to do," she said. "Anson's in there, everybody is, and the cops are just standing around."
"Probably don't want to get beat up any worse than they already have been, and I don't blame them. This was well planned and beautifully executed."
"What are you talking about?"
"Never mind. Want to take a shot at stopping it before it gets any worse?"
"How?"
He lifted the bullhorn plucked from the hood of the car where Toby Whalen left it. When he tried to hand it to her, Rose drew back, holding her hands to her chest.
"You do it, Barbie."
"No. You're the one who's been feeding them for years. You're the one they know. You're the one they'll listen to." She took the bullhorn, although hesitantly.
"I don't know what to say. I can't think of a single thing that will make them stop. Toby Whalen already tried. They didn't pay any attention."
"Toby tried to give orders," Barbie said. "Giving orders to a mob is like giving orders to an anthill."
"I still don't know what to..."
"I'm going to tell you." Barbie spoke calmly, and that calmed her. He paused long enough to beckon Linda Everett. She and Jackie came together, their arms around each other's waists. "Can you get in touch with your husband?" Barbie asked.
"If his cell phone's on."
"Tell him to get down here, with an ambulance if possible. If he doesn't answer his phone, grab a police car and drive on up to the hospital."
"He's got patients."
"He's got some patients right here, he just doesn't know it." Barbie pointed to Ginny Tomlinson, now sitting with her back against the cinder block side of the market and her hands pressed to her bleeding face. Gina and Harriet Bigelow crouched on either side of her, but when Gina tried to staunch the bleeding from Ginny's radically altered nose with a folded handkerchief, Ginny cried out in pain and turned her head away, starting with one of his two remaining trained nurses, if I'm not mistaken.
"What are you going to do?"
Linda asked, taking her cell phone from her belt.
"Rose and I are going to make them stop. Aren't we, Rose?"
12. Rose stopped inside the door, mesmerized by the chaos before her. The eye-watering smell of vinegar was in the air, mingled with the aromas of brine and beer. Mustard and ketchup were splattered like gaudy puke on the linoleum of aisle 3. A cloud of mingled sugar and flour arose from aisle 5. People pushed their loaded shopping carts through it, many coughing and wiping their eyes. Some of the carts slewed as they rolled through a drift of spilled dry beans. Stay there a sec, Barbie said, although Rose showed no sign of moving. She was hypnotized with the bullhorn clasped between her breasts. Barbie found Julia shooting pictures of the looted cash registers.
Quit that, and come with me, he said.
No, I have to do this, and there's no one else. I don't know where Pete Freeman is, and Tony...
You don't have to shoot it, you have to stop it, before something a lot worse than that happens.
He was pointing to Fern Bowie, who was strolling past with a loaded basket in one hand and a beer in the other. His eyebrow was split and blood was dripping down his face, but Fern seemed content enough with all.
How?
He led her back to Rose. Ready, Rose? Showtime.
Well...
Remember, serene. Don't try to stop them. Just try to lower the temperature. Rose took a deep breath, then raised the bullhorn to her mouth.
Hi, everybody. This is Rose Twitchell from Sweetbriar Rose.
To her everlasting credit, she did sound serene. People looked around when they heard her voice. Not because it sounded urgent, Barbie knew, but because it didn't. He had seen this in Tikrit, Fallujah, Baghdad, mostly after bombings in crowded public places, when the police and the troop carriers arrived.
Please finish your shopping as quickly and as calmly as possible.
A few people chuckled at this, then looked around at each other as if coming too. In aisle 7, Carla Venziano, shamefaced, helped Henrietta Clabber to her feet. There's plenty of text, Maddie, for both of us, Carla thought. What in God's name was I thinking? Barbie nodded at Rose to go on, mouthing, coffee. In the distance, he could hear the sweet warble of an approaching ambulance.
When you're done, come to Sweetbriar for coffee. It's fresh, and it's on the house.
A few people clapped.
Some leather lungs yelled, Who wants coffee? We got beer.
Laughter and whoops greeted this sally. Julia twitched Barbie's sleeve. Her forehead was creased in what Barbie thought was a very Republican frown.
They're not shopping, they're stealing.
Do you want to editorialize or get them out of here before someone gets killed over a bag of Blue Mountain dry roast? He asked.
She thought it over and nodded, her frown giving way to that inward-turning smile he was coming to like a great deal.
You have a point, Colonel, she said.
Barbie turned to Rose, made a cranking gesture, and she started in again. He began to walk the two women up and down the aisles, starting with the mostly denuded deli and dairy section, on the lookout for anyone who might be cranked up enough to offer interference. There was no one. Rose was gaining confidence and the market was quieting. People were leaving. Many were pushing carts laden with loot, but Barbie still took it as a good sign. The sooner they were out, the better, no matter how much shit they took with them. And the key was for them to hear themselves referred to as shoppers rather than stealers. Give a man or woman back his self-respect. And in most cases, not all, but most. You also give back that person's ability to think with at least some clarity. Anson Wheeler joined them, pushing a shopping cart full of supplies. He looked slightly shamefaced, and his arm was bleeding.
Someone hit me with a jar of olives, he explained. Now I smell like an Italian sandwich.
Rose handed the bullhorn to Julia, who began broadcasting the same message in the same pleasant voice. Finish up, shoppers, and leave in orderly fashion.
We can't take that stuff, Rose said, pointing at Anson's cart.
But we need it, Rosie, he said.
He sounded apologetic but firm.
We really do.
We'll leave some money then, she said. If no one's stolen my purse out of the truck, that is.
I don't think that'll work, Anson said. Some guys were stealing the money out of the registers.
He had seen which guys, but didn't want to say. Not with the editor of the local paper walking next to him. Rose was horrified.
What's happening here? In the name of God, what's happening?
I don't know, Anson said.
Outside, the ambulance pulled up, the siren dying to a growl. A minute or two later, while Barbie, Rose, and Julia were still canvassing the aisles with the bullhorn, the crowd was thinning out now. Someone behind them said, That's enough, give me that. Barbie was not surprised to see Acting Chief Randolph, tricked out to the nines in his dress uniform. Here he was, a day late and a dollar short, right on schedule. Rose was working the bullhorn, extolling the virtues of free coffee at Sweetbriar. Randolph plucked it from her hand and immediately began giving orders and making threats.
Leave now. This is Chief Peter Randolph ordering you to leave now. Drop what you are holding and leave now. If you drop what you're holding and leave now, you may avoid charges.
Rose looked at Barbie dismayed. He shrugged. It didn't matter. The spirit of the mob had departed. The cops who were still ambulatory, even Carter Thibodeau, staggering but on his feet, started hustling people out. When the shoppers wouldn't drop their loaded baskets, the cops struck several to the ground, and Frank de Lesseps overturned a loaded shopping cart. His face was grim and pale and angry.
Are you going to make those boys stop that? Julia asked Randolph.
No, Miss Shumway, I am not, Randolph said. Those people are looters, and they're being treated as such.
Whose fault is that? Who closed the market?
Get out of my way, Randolph said. I've got work to do.
Shame you weren't here when they broke in, Barbie remarked. Randolph looked at him. The glance was unfriendly, yet satisfied. Barbie sighed. Somewhere a clock was ticking. He knew it, and Randolph did too. Soon the alarm would ring. If not for the dome, he could run. But of course, if not for the dome, none of this would be happening. Down front, Mel Searles tried to take Al Timmons' loaded shopping basket. When Al wouldn't give it up, Mel tore it away, and then pushed the older man down. Al cried out in pain and shame and outrage. Chief Randolph laughed. It was a short, choppy, unamused sound. Haw, haw, haw. And in it, Barbie thought he heard what Chester's Mill might soon become, if the dome didn't lift. Come on, ladies, he said. Let's get out of here.
13.
Rusty and Twitch were lining up the wounded, about a dozen in all, along the cinderblock side of the market when Barbie, Julia, and Rose came out. Anson was standing by the Sweetbriar panel truck with a paper towel pressed to his bleeding arm. Rusty's face was grim, but when he saw Barbie, he lightened up a little.
Hey, sport, you're with me this morning. In fact, you're my new RN.
You wildly overestimate my triage skills, Barbie said, but he walked toward Rusty. Linda Everett ran past Barbie and threw herself into Rusty's arms. He gave her a brief hug.
Can I help, honey? She asked.
It was Ginny she was looking at, and with horror. Ginny saw the look and wearily closed her eyes.
No, Rusty said. You do what you need to. I've got Gina and Harriet, and I've got Nurse Barbara.
I'll do what I can, Barbie said, and almost added, until I'm arrested, that is.
You'll be fine, Rusty said. In a lower voice, he added, Gina and Harriet are the most willing helpers in the world, but once they get past giving pills and slapping on band-aids, they're pretty much lost.
Linda bent to Ginny.
I'm so sorry, she said. I'll be fine, Ginny said,
but she did not open her eyes. Linda gave her husband a kiss and a troubled look, then walked back toward where Jackie Weddington was standing with a pad in her hand, taking Ernie Calvert's statement. Ernie wiped his eyes repeatedly as he talked. Rusty and Barbie worked side by side for over an hour, while the cops strung yellow police tape in front of the market. At some point, Andy Sanders came down to survey the damage, clucking and shaking his head. Barbie heard him ask someone what the world was coming to, when hometown folks could get up to a thing like this. He also shook Chief Randolph's hand and told him he was doing a hell of a job. Hell of a job.
14.
When you're feeling it, lousy breaks disappear. Strife becomes your friend. Bad luck turns hit the megabucks good. You do not accept these things with gratitude, an emotion reserved for wimps and losers in Big Jim Rennie's opinion, but as you do. Feeling it is like riding in a magic swing, and one should, once more in Big Jim's opinion, glide imperiously. If he had emerged from the big old Rennie manse on Mill Street a little later or a little earlier, he would not have seen what he did, and he might have dealt with Brenda Perkins in an entirely different way. But he came out at exactly the right time. That was how it went when you were feeling it. The defense collapsed, and you rushed through the magical hole thus created, making the easy layup.
It was the chanted cries of "Open up, open up," that got him out of his study, where he had been making notes for what he planned to call the Disaster Administration, of which cheerful, grinning Andy Sanders would be the titular head, and Big Jim would be the power behind the throne. "If it ain't broke, don't fix it," was rule one in Big Jim's political operating manual, and having Andy out front always worked like a charm. Most of Chester's Mill knew he was an idiot, but it didn't matter. You could run the same game on people over and over, because 98% of them were even bigger idiots. And although Big Jim had never planned a political campaign on such a grand scale, it amounted to a municipal dictatorship. He had no doubt it would work. He hadn't included Brenda Perkins in his list of possible complicating factors, but no matter. When you were feeling it, complicating factors had a way of disappearing. This you also accepted as your due. He walked down the sidewalk to the corner of Mill and Main, a distance of no more than 100 paces, with his belly swinging placidly before him. The town common was directly across the way. A little farther down the hill, on the other side of the street, were the town hall and the PD, with War Memorial Plaza in between. He couldn't see Food City from the corner, but he could see all of the Main Street business section. And he saw Julia Shumway. She came hurrying out of the Democrat's office, a camera in one hand. She jogged down the street toward the sound of the chanting, trying to sling the camera over her shoulder while on the move. Big Jim watched her. It was funny, really, how anxious she was to get to the latest disaster. It got funnier. She stopped, turned, jogged back, tried the newspaper office's door, found it open, and locked it. Then she hurried off once more, anxious to watch her friends and neighbors behaving badly. She is realizing for the first time that once the beast is out of its cage, it could bite anyone, anywhere, Big Jim thought. "But don't worry, Julia. I'll take care of you, just as I always have. You may have to tone down that tiresome rag of yours. But isn't that a small price to pay for safety?" Of course it was. And if she persisted... "Sometimes stuff happens," Big Jim said. He was standing on the corner with his hands in his pockets, smiling. And when he heard the first screams, the sound of breaking glass, the gunshots, his smile widened. "Stuff happens" wasn't exactly how Junior put it, but Big Jim reckoned it was close enough for government His smile folded into a frown as he spotted Brenda Perkins. Most of the people on Main Street were heading toward Food City to see what all the ruckus was about, but Brenda was walking up Main Street instead of down. Maybe even up to the Rennie house, which would mean up to no good. "What could she want with me this morning? What could be so important it trumps a food riot at the local supermarket?" It was entirely possible he was the last thing on Brenda's mind, but his radar was pinging and he watched her closely. She and Julia passed on opposite sides of the street. Neither noticed the other. Julia was trying to run while managing her camera. Brenda was staring at the red ramshackle bulk of Burpee's department store. She had a canvas carrier bag that swung at her knee. When she reached Burpee's, Brenda tried the door with no success. Then she stood back and glanced around the way people do when they've hit an unexpected obstacle to their plans and are trying to decide what to do next. She might still have seen Shumway if she'd looked behind her, but she didn't. Brenda looked left, right, then across Main Street at the offices of the Democrat. After another look at Burpee's, she crossed to the Democrat and tried that door. Also locked, of course. Big Jim had watched Julia do it. Brenda tried it again, rattling the knob for good measure. She knocked, peered in. Then she stood back, hands on hips, carrier bag dangling. When she once more started up Main Street, trudging, no longer looking around, Big Jim retreated to his house at a brisk pace. He didn't know why he wanted to make sure Brenda didn't see him watching, but he didn't have to know. You only had to act on your instincts when you were feeling it. That was the beauty of the thing. What he did know was that if Brenda knocked on his door, he would be ready for her, no matter what she wanted. 15. "Tomorrow morning I want you to take the printout to Julia Shumway," Barbie had told her. But the Democrat's office was locked and dark.
Julia was almost certainly at whatever mess was going on at the market. Pete Freeman and Tony Gay probably were, too.
So what was she supposed to do with Howie's Vader file?
If there had been a mail slot, she might have slipped the manila envelope in her carrier bag through it. Only there was no mail slot. Brenda supposed she should either go find Julia at the market or return home to wait until things quieted down and Julia came back to her office. Not being in a particularly logical mood, neither choice appealed. As to the former, it sounded like a full-scale riot was going on at Food City, and Brenda did not want to get sucked in. As to the latter, that was clearly the better choice, the sensible choice. Hadn't all things come to him who waits been one of Howie's favorite sayings? But waiting had never been Brenda's forte, and her mother had also had a saying, do it, and have done with it. That was what she wanted to do now, face him, wait out his ranting, his denials, his justifications, and then give him his choice. Resign in favor of Dale Barbara, or read all about his dirty deeds in the Democrat. Confrontation was bitter medicine to her, and the thing to do with bitter medicine was swallow it as fast as you could, then rinse your mouth. She planned to rinse hers with a double bourbon, and she wouldn't wait until noon to do it either. Only, don't go alone. Barbie had said that too. And when he'd asked who else she trusted, she'd said Romeo Burpee. But Burpee's was closed too. What did that leave? The question was whether or not Big Jim would actually hurt her, and Brenda thought the answer was no. She believed she was physically safe from Big Jim no matter what worries Barbie might have, worries that were no doubt partly the result of his wartime experiences. This was a dreadful miscalculation on her part, but understandable. She wasn't the only one who clung to the notion that the world was as it had been before the dome came down. 16. Which still left the problem of the Vader file. Brenda might be more afraid of Big Jim's tongue than of bodily harm, but she knew it would be mad to show up on his doorstep with the file still in her possession. He might take it from her, even if she said it wasn't the only copy. That she would not put past him. Halfway uptown Common Hill, she came to Presteel Street, cutting along the upper edge of the common. The first house belonged to the McCains. The one beyond was Andrea Grinnell's, and although Andrea was almost always overshadowed by her male counterparts on the Board of Selectmen, Brenda knew she was honest and had no love for Big Jim. Oddly enough, it was Andy Sanders to whom Andrea was more apt to kowtow, although why anyone would take him seriously was beyond Brenda's understanding. Maybe he's got some sort of hold on her, Howie's voice spoke up in her head. Brenda almost laughed. That was ridiculous. The important thing about Andrea was that she had been a Twitchell before Tommy Grinnell married her, and Twitchells were tough, even the shy ones. Brenda thought she could leave the envelope containing the Vader file with Andrea, assuming her place wasn't also locked and empty. She didn't think it would be. Hadn't she heard from someone that Andrea was down with the flu? Brenda crossed Main, rehearsing what she'd say. Would you hold this for me? I'll be back for it in about half an hour. If I don't come back for it, give it to Julia at the newspaper. Also, make sure Dale Barbara knows. And if she was asked what all the mystery was about, Brenda decided she'd be frank. The news that she intended to force Jim Rennie's resignation would probably do Andrea more good than a double dose of Theraflu. In spite of her desire to get her distasteful errand done, Brenda paused for a moment in front of the McCain house. It looked deserted, but there was nothing strange about that. Plenty of families had been out of town when the dome came down. It was something else. A faint smell, for one thing, as if food were spoiling in there. All at once the day felt hotter, the air closer, and the sounds of whatever was going on at Food City seemed far away. Brenda realized what it came down to. She felt watched. She stood thinking about how much those shaded windows looked like closed eyes, but not completely closed, no, peeking eyes. Shake it off, woman, you've got things to do. She walked on to Andrea's house, pausing once to look back over her shoulder. She saw nothing but a house with drawn shades, sitting gloomily in the mild stink of its decaying supplies. Only meat smelled so bad so soon.
Henry and LaDonna must have had a lot put by in their freezer, she thought.
17.
It was Junior who watched Brenda. Junior on his knees. Junior dressed only in his underpants, his head whamming and slamming. He watched from the living room, peering around the edge of a drawn shade. When she was gone, he went back into the pantry. He would have to give his girlfriends up soon, he knew. But for now, he wanted them. And he wanted the dark. He even wanted the stink rising from their blackening skin. Anything, anything that would soothe his fiercely aching head.
18. After three twists of the old-fashioned crank doorbell, Brenda resigned herself to going home after all. She was turning away when she heard slow, shuffling steps approaching the door. She arranged a little "hello, neighbor" smile on her face. It froze there when she saw Andrea. Cheeks pale, dark circles under her eyes, hair in disarray, cinching the belt of a bathrobe around her middle, pajamas underneath. And this house smelled, too. Not of decaying meat, but of vomit. Andrea's smile was as wan as her cheeks and brow.
I know how I look, she said.
The words came out in a croak.
I better not invite you in. I'm on the mend, but I still might be catching.
Have you seen Dr.? But no, of course not. Dr. Haskell was dead. Have you seen Rusty Everett?
Indeed I have, Andrea said. All will soon be well, I'm told. You're perspiring. Still a little touch of fever, but it's almost gone. Can I help you with something, Bren?
She almost said no. She didn't want to saddle a woman who was still clearly sick with a responsibility like the one in her carrier bag. But then Andrea said something that changed her mind. Great events often turn on small wheels.
I'm so sorry about Howie. I love that man.
Thank you, Andrea. Not just for the sympathy, but for calling him Howie, instead of Duke. To Brenda, he'd always been Howie, her dear Howie, and the Vader file was his last work, probably his greatest work. Brenda suddenly decided to put it to work, and with no further delay. She dipped into the carrier bag and brought out the manila envelope with Julia's name printed on the front.
Will you hold this for me, dear? Just for a little while. I have an errand to run, and I don't want to take it with me.
Brenda would have answered any questions Andrea asked, but Andrea apparently had none. She only took the bulky envelope with a sort of distracted courtesy. And that was all right. It saved time. Also, it would keep Andrea out of the loop, and might spare her political blowback at some later date.
Happy to, Andrea said. And now, if you'll excuse me, I think I better get off my feet. But I'm not going to sleep, she added, as if Brenda had objected to this plan. I'll hear you when you come back.
Thank you, Brenda said. Are you drinking juices?
By the gallon. Take your time, hon. I'll babysit your envelope.
Brenda was going to thank her again, but the mill's third selectman had already closed the door.
19.
Toward the end of her conversation with Brenda, Andrea's stomach began to flutter. She fought it, but this was a fight she was going to lose. She blathered something about drinking juice, told Brenda to take her time, then closed the door in the poor woman's face and sprinted for her stinking bathroom, making guttural urk-urk noises deep down in her throat. There was an end table beside the living room couch, and she tossed the manila envelope at it blindly as she rushed past. The envelope skittered across the polished surface and fell off the other side, into the dark space between the table and the couch. Andrea made it to the bathroom, but not to the toilet, which was just as well. It was nearly filled with the stagnant, stinking brew that had been her body's output during the endless night just past. She leaned over the basin instead, retching until it seemed to her that her very esophagus would come loose and land on the splattery porcelain, still warm and pulsing. That didn't happen. But the world turned gray and teetered away from her on high heels, growing smaller and less tangible as she swayed and tried not to faint. When she felt a little better, she walked slowly down the hall on elastic legs,
sliding one hand along the wood to keep her balance. She was shivering, and she could hear the jittery clitter of her teeth, a horrible sound she seemed to pick up not with her ears but with the backs of her eyes. She didn't even consider trying to reach her bedroom upstairs, but went out onto the screened-in back porch instead. The porch should have been too cold to be comfortable this late in October, but today the air was sultry. She did not lie down on the old chaise longue so much as collapse into its musty but somehow comforting embrace. "I'll get up in a minute," she told herself, "get the last bottle of Poland Spring out of the fridge, and wash that foul taste out of my mouth." But here her thoughts slipped away. She fell into a deep and profound sleep from which not even the restless twitching of her feet and hands could wake her. She had many dreams. One was of a terrible fire people ran from, coughing and retching, looking for any place where they might find air that was still cool and clean. Another was of Brenda Perkins coming to her door and giving her an envelope. When Andrea opened it, a never-ending stream of pink OxyContin pills poured out. By the time she woke up, it was evening, and the dreams were forgotten. So was Brenda Perkins' visit. 20.
"Come into my study," Big Jim said cheerfully. "Or would you like something fresh to drink first? I have Cokes, although I'm afraid they're a little warm. My generator died last night, out of propane. But I imagine you know where you can get more," she said.
He raised his eyebrows questioningly.
"The methamphetamine you're making," she said patiently. "My understanding, based on Howie's notes, is that you've been cooking it in large batches. Amounts that boggle the mind, is how he put it. That must take a lot of propane gas."
Now that she was actually into this, she found her jitters had melted away. She even took a certain cold pleasure in watching the color mount in his cheeks and go dashing across his forehead.
"I have no idea what you're talking about. I think you're grief."
He sighed, spread his blunt-fingered hands.
"Come inside. We'll discuss this, and I'll set your mind at rest."
She smiled. That she could smile was sort of a revelation, and it helped more to imagine Howie watching her from somewhere, also telling her to be careful. That was advice she planned to heed. On the Rennie front lawn, two Adirondack chairs sat amid the fallen leaves.
"It's nice enough out here for me," she said. "I prefer to talk business inside."
"Would you prefer to see your picture on the front page of the Democrat? Because I can arrange that." He winced, as if she had struck him, and for just a moment she saw hate in those small, deep-set, piggy eyes.
"Duke never liked me, and I suppose it's natural that his feelings should have been communicated to—" "His name was Howie."
Big Jim threw up his hands as if to say there was no reasoning with some women, and led her to the chairs overlooking Mill Street. Brenda Perkins talked for almost half an hour, growing colder and angrier as she spoke. The meth lab, with Andy Sanders, and almost certainly Lester Coggins as silent partners. The staggering size of the thing. Its probable location. The mid-level distributors, who had been promised immunity in exchange for information. The money trail. How the operation had gotten so big the local pharmacist could no longer safely supply the necessary ingredients, necessitating import from overseas. The stuff came into town in trucks marked Gideon Bible Society, Brenda said. Howie's comment on that was, "Too clever by half." Big Jim sat looking out at the silent residential street. She could feel the anger and hate baking off him. It was like heat from a casserole dish.
"You can't prove any of this," he said at last.
"That won't matter if Howie's file turns up in the Democrat. It's not due process. But if anyone can understand bypassing a little thing like that, it would be you."
He flapped a hand.
"Oh, I'm sure you had a file," he said. "But my name is on nothing."
"It's on the town ventures paperwork," she said.
and Big Jim rocked in his chair as if she had lashed out with her fist and hit him in the temple.
Town Ventures, Incorporated in Carson City. And from Nevada, the money trail leads to Chongqing City, the pharma capital of the People's Republic of China. She smiled. You thought you were smart, didn't you? So smart.
Where is this file?
I left a copy with Julia this morning.
Bringing Andrea into it was the last thing she wanted to do.
And thinking it was in the newspaper editor's hands would bring him to heel that much quicker. He might feel that he or Andy Sanders could jawbone Andrea.
There are other copies.
What do you think?
He considered a moment, then said, I kept it out of the town.
She said nothing.
It was for the good of the town.
You've done a lot of good for the town, Jim. We've got the same sewer system we had in 1960. Chester Pond is filthy. The business district is moribund.
She was sitting straight now, gripping the arms of her chair.
You fucking self-righteous turd worm.
What do you want?
He was staring straight ahead at the empty street. A large vein beat in his temple.
For you to announce your resignation, Barbie takes over as per the president's...
I'll never resign in favor of that cotton picker.
He turned to look at her. He was smiling. It was an appalling smile.
You didn't leave anything with Julia, because Julia's at the market watching the food fight. You might have Duke's file locked away somewhere, but you didn't leave a copy with anyone. You tried Rami, then you tried Julia, then you came here. I saw you walking uptown Common Hill.
I did, she said. I did have it.
And if she told him where she had left it, bad luck for Andrea. She started to get up.
You had your chance. Now I'm leaving.
Your other mistake was thinking you'd be safe outside on the street. An empty street.
His voice was almost kind, and when he touched her arm, she turned to look at him. He seized her face and twisted. Brenda Perkins heard a bitter crack, like the breaking of a branch overloaded with ice, and followed the sound into a great darkness, trying to call her husband's name as she went. 21. Big Jim went inside and got a Jim Rennie's used car's gimme cap from the front hall closet, also some gloves, and a pumpkin from the pantry. Brenda was still in her Adirondack chair with her chin on her chest. He looked around. No one. The world was his. He put the hat on her head, pulling the brim low, the gloves on her hands, and the pumpkin in her lap. It would serve perfectly well, he thought, until Junior came back and took her to where she could become part of Dale Barbara's butcher's bill. Until then, she was just another stuffed Halloween dummy. He checked her carrier bag. It contained her wallet, a comb, and a paperback novel. So that was all right. It would be fine down cellar, behind the dead furnace. He left her with the hat slouched on her head and the pumpkin in her lap, and went inside to stash her bag and wait for his son. In the Jug. 1. Selectman Rennie's assumption that no one had seen Brenda come to his house that morning was correct. But she was seen on her morning travels, not by one person, but by three, including one who also lived on Mill Street. If Big Jim had known, would the knowledge have given him pause? Doubtful. By then he was committed to his course, and it was too late to turn back. But it might have caused him to reflect, for he was a reflective man in his own way, on murder's similarity to Lay's potato chips. It's hard to stop with just one. 2. Big Jim didn't see the watchers when he came down to the corner of Mill and Main. Neither did Brenda as she walked uptown Common Hill. This was because they didn't want to be seen. They were sheltering just inside the Peace Bridge, which happened to be a condemned structure. But that wasn't the worst of it. If Claire McClatchy had seen the cigarettes, she would have shit a brick. In fact, she might have shit too. And certainly, she never would have let Joe chum with Nori Calvert again. Not even if the fate of the town hinged upon their association, because it was Nori who supplied the smokes, badly bent and croggled Winstons, which she had found on a shelf in the garage.
Her father had quit smoking the year before, and the pack was covered with a fine scrim of dust, but the cigarettes inside had looked okay to Nori. There were just three, but three was perfect, one each. Think of it as a good luck rite, she instructed.
We'll smoke like Indians praying to the gods for a successful hunt. Then we'll go to work.
Sounds good, Joe said.
He had always been curious about smoking. He couldn't see the attraction, but there must be one, because a lot of people still did it.
Which gods?
Benny Drake asked.
The gods of your choice, Nori answered, looking at him as if he were the dumbest creature in the universe. God, if that's the one you like.
Dressed in faded denim shorts and a pink sleeveless top, her hair for once down and framing her foxy little face instead of scooped back in its usual slopping-around-town ponytail, she looked good to both boys. Totally awesome, in fact.
I pray to Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman is not a goddess, Joe said, taking one of the elderly Winstons and smoothing it straight. Wonder Woman is a superhero.
He considered.
Maybe a superhero-ette.
She's a goddess to me,
Nori replied with a grave-eyed sincerity that could not be gainsaid, let alone ridiculed. She was carefully straightening her own cigarette. Benny left his the way it was. He thought a bent cigarette had a certain coolness factor.
I had Wonder Woman power bracelets until I was 9, but then I lost them. I think that bitch Yvonne Nadeau stole them.
She lit a match and touched it first to Scarecrow Joe's cigarette, then to Benny's. When she tried to use it to light her own, Benny blew it out.
What did you do that for? She asked.
We had a match, bad luck.
You believe that?
Not much, Benny said, but today we're going to need all the luck we can get.
He glanced at the shopping bag and the basket of his bike, then took a pull on his cigarette. He inhaled a little and then coughed the smoke back out, his eyes watering.
This tastes like panther shit.
Smoked a lot of that, have you? Joe asked.
He dragged on his own cigarette. He didn't want to look like a wuss, but he didn't want to start coughing and maybe throw up either. The smoke burned, but in sort of a good way. Maybe there was something to this, after all. Only he already felt a little woozy. Go easy on the inhaling part, he thought. Passing out would be almost as uncool as puking. Unless maybe he passed out in Nori Calvert's lap. That might be very cool indeed. Nori reached into her shorts pocket and brought out the cap of a very fine juice bottle.
We can use this for an ashtray. I want to do the Indian smoke ritual, but I don't want to catch the peace bridge on fire.
She then closed her eyes. Her lips began to move. Her cigarette was between her fingers, growing in ash. Benny looked at Joe, shrugged, then closed his own eyes.
Almighty G.I. Joe, please hear the prayer of your humble PFC Drake.
Nori kicked him without opening her eyes. Joe got up, a little dizzy, but not too bad. He chanced another drag when he was on his feet, and walked past their parked bikes to the town common end of the covered walkway.
Where are you going?
Nori asked, without opening her eyes.
I pray better when I look at nature, Joe said,
but he actually just wanted a breath of fresh air. It wasn't the burning tobacco. He sort of liked that. It was the other smells inside the bridge. Decaying wood, old booze, and a sour chemical aroma that seemed to be rising up from the prestige beneath them.
That was a smell, the chef might have told him, that you could come to love.
Even the outside air wasn't that wonderful. It had a slightly used quality that made Joe think of the trip he'd made with his parents to New York the previous year. The subways had smelled a little like this, especially late in the day, when they were crowded with people headed home. He tapped ashes into his hand. As he scattered them, he spotted Brenda Perkins making her way up the hill. A moment later, a hand touched his shoulder, too light and delicate to be Benny's.
Who's that?
Nori asked.
No, the face, not the name, he said.
Benny joined them.
That's Mrs. Perkins, the sheriff's widow.
Nori elbowed him.
Police, chief, dummy.
Benny shrugged.
Whatever.
They watched her, mostly because there was no one else to watch. The rest of the town was at the supermarket, apparently having the world's biggest food fight. The three kids had investigated, but from afar. They did not need persuasion to stay away. given the valuable piece of equipment that had been entrusted to their care.
Brenda crossed Main to Prestille, paused outside the McCain house, then went on to Mrs. Grinnell's.
"Let's get going," Benny said.
"We can't get going until she's gone," Nori said.
Benny shrugged.
"What's the big deal if she sees us? We're just some kids goofing around on the town common. And know what? She probably wouldn't see us if she looked right at us. Adults never see kids."
He considered this.
"Unless they're on skateboards.
Or smoking," Nori added. They all glanced at their cigarettes.
Joe hooked a thumb at the shopping bag sitting in the carrier attached to the handlebars of Benny's Schwinn High Plains.
"They also have a tendency to see kids who are goofing around with expensive town property."
Nori tucked her cigarette in the corner of her mouth. It made her look wonderfully tough, wonderfully pretty, and wonderfully adult. The boys went back to watching. The police chief's widow was now talking to Mrs. Grinnell. It wasn't a long conversation. Mrs. Perkins had taken a big brown envelope from her carrier bag as she came up the steps, and they watched her hand it to Mrs. Grinnell. A few seconds later, Mrs. Grinnell pretty much slammed the door in her visitor's face.
"Whoa, that was rude," Benny said. "Week's detention."
Joe and Nori laughed. Mrs. Perkins stood where she was for a moment as if perplexed, then went back down the steps. She was now facing the common, and the three children instinctively stepped further into the shadows of the walkway. This caused them to lose sight of her, but Joe found a handy gap in the wooden siding and peered through that.
"Going back to Maine," he reported.
"Okay, now she's going up the hill. Now she's crossing over again."
Benny held an imaginary microphone.
"Video at 11.
Joe ignored this.
"Now she's going onto my street."
He turned to Benny and Nori.
"Do you think she's going to see my mom?"
"Mill Street's 4 blocks long, dude," Benny said. "What are the chances?"
Joe felt relieved, even though he could think of no reason why Mrs. Perkins going to see his mom would be a bad thing. Except his mother was all worried about Dad being out of town. And Joe would sure hate to see her more upset than she already was. She had almost forbidden him to go on this expedition. Thank God Ms. Shumway had talked her out of that idea, mostly by telling her that Dale Barbara had mentioned Joe specifically for this job, which Joe, Benny and Nori too, preferred to think of as the mission.
"Mrs. McClatchy," Julia had said, "if anyone can put this gadget to use, Barbie thinks it's probably your son. It could be very important."
That made Joe feel good, but looking at his mother's face, worried, drawn, made him feel bad. It hadn't even been 3 days since the dome had come down, but she'd lost weight. And the way she kept holding his dad's picture, that made him feel bad, too. It was like she thought he'd died instead of just being holed up in a motel somewhere, probably drinking beer and watching HBO. She had agreed with Ms. Shumway, though.
"He's a smart boy, about gadgets, all right, always has been."
She looked him over from head to foot and sighed.
"When did you get so tall, son?"
"I don't know,"
he had replied truthfully.
"If I let you do this, will you be careful? And take your friends with you," Julia said.
"Benny and Nori, sure."
"Also," Julia had added, "be a little discreet. Do you know what that means, Joe?"
"Yes, ma'am, I sure do."
It meant, don't get caught. 3. Brenda disappeared into the screening trees that lined Mill Street.
"Okay," Benny said, "let's go."
He carefully crushed a cigarette in the makeshift ashtray, then lifted the shopping bag out of the bike's wire carrier. Inside the bag was the old-fashioned yellow Geiger counter, which had gone from Barbie to Rusty to Julia, and finally to Joe and his posse. Joe took the juice lid and crushed out his own smoke, thinking he would like to try again when he had more time to concentrate on the experience. On the other hand, it might be better not to. He was addicted to computers, the graphic novels of Brian K. Vaughan, and skateboarding. Maybe that was enough monkeys for one back.
"People are going to come by," he said to Benny and Nori. "Probably lots of people once they get tired of playing in the supermarket. We'll just have to hope they don't pay any attention to us."
In his mind, he heard Ms. Shumway telling his mom how important this could be to the town. She didn't have to tell him. He probably understood it better than they did.
"But if any cops come by," Nori said,
Joe nodded.
Back into the bag it goes, and out comes the frisbee.
You really think there's some kind of alien generator buried under the town common? Benny asked.
I said there might be, Joe replied, more sharply than he had intended. Anything's possible.
In truth, Joe thought it more than possible. He thought it likely. If the dome wasn't supernatural in origin, then it was a force field. A force field had to be generated. It looked like a QED situation to him, but he didn't want to get their hopes up too high, or his own, for that matter.
Let's start looking, Nori said.
She ducked under the sagging yellow police tape.
I just hope you two prayed enough.
Joe didn't believe in praying for things he could do for himself, but he had sent up a brief one on a different subject, that if they found the generator, Nori Calvert would give him another kiss. A nice long one.
4. Earlier that morning during their pre-exploration meeting in the McClatchy living room, Scarecrow Joe had taken off his right sneaker, then the white athletic sock beneath it.
Trick-or-treat, smell my feet, give me something good to eat, Benny said cheerfully.
Shut up, stupid,
Joe replied.
Don't call your friend stupid,
Claire McClatchy said, but she gave Benny a reproachful look. Nori added no repartee of her own, only watched with interest as Joe laid the sock on the living room rug and smoothed it out with the flat of his hand.
This is Chester's Mill, Joe said. Same shape, right?
You are correctamundo, Benny agreed. It's our fate to live in a town that looks like one of Joe McClatchy's athletic socks.
Or the old woman's shoe, Nori put in.
There was an old woman who lived in a shoe, Mrs. McClatchy recited. She was sitting on the couch with the picture of her husband in her lap, just as she had been when Ms. Shumway came by with the Geiger counter late yesterday afternoon. She had so many children she didn't know what to do.
Good one, Mom,
Joe said, trying not to grin. The middle school version had been revised to, she had so many children her cunt fell off. He looked down at the sock again.
So, does a sock have a middle?
Benny and Nori thought it over. Joe let them. The fact that such a question could interest them was one of the things he dug about them.
Not like a circle or square has a center, Nori said at last. Those are geometric shapes.
Benny said, I guess a sock is also a geometric shape, technically, but I don't know what you'd call it. A soctagon?
Nori laughed. Even Claire smiled a little.
On the map, the mill's closer to a hexagon, Joe said, but never mind that. Just use common sense.
Nori pointed to the place on the sock where the foot-shaped bottom flowed into the tube top.
There. That's the middle.
Joe dotted it with the tip of his pen.
I'm not sure that'll come out, mister,
Claire sighed.
But you need new ones anyway, I suppose.
And before he could ask the next question, she said, on a map, that would be about where the town common is. Is that where you're going to look?
That's where we're going to look first, Joe said, a little deflated at having his explicatory thunder stolen.
Because if there's a generator, Mrs. McClatchy mused, you think it should be in the middle of the township, or as close to it as possible.
Joe nodded.
Cool, Mrs. McClatchy, Benny said.
He raised one hand.
Give me five, mother of my soul, brother.
Smiling wanly, still holding the picture of her husband, Claire McClatchy slapped Benny five. Then she said, at least the town common's a safe place. She paused to consider that, frowning slightly. I hope so, anyway, but who really knows?
Don't worry, Nori said. I'll watch out for them.
Just promise me that if you do find something, you'll let the experts handle things, Claire said.
Mom, Joe thought, I think maybe we're the experts. But he didn't say it. He knew it would bum her out even more.
What up?
Benny said, and held his hand up again.
Five more, oh mother of my...
This time, she kept both hands on the picture.
I love you, Benny, but sometimes you tire me out.
He smiled sadly.
My mom says the exact same thing.
5.
Joe and his friends walked downhill to the bandstand that stood in the center of the common. Behind them, the Prestige murmured. It was lower now, dammed up by the dome where it crossed into Chester's Mill from the northwest. If the dome was still in place tomorrow,
Joe thought it would be nothing but a mudslick.
Okay, Benny said. Enough with the Freddy fuck-around. Time for the board bangers to rescue Chester's Mill. Let's fire that baby up.
Carefully,